A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about how we treat breakfast, lunch, and dinner like they're laws of nature, when really they're just a habit we picked up recently. He wants us to dig into the forgotten meal schedules of pre-modern societies. Ancient Rome, medieval Europe, Edo period Japan, and then actually give people some practical remixes they could adopt without looking like they're cosplaying at the Renaissance fair. What if you moved your main meal to 3 in the afternoon and called it a cena? What if you just ate twice a day like a medieval peasant and called it good? Let's get into it.
The thing that knocked me flat when I started reading about this is just how recent the 3-meal structure actually is. The BBC Future piece on forgotten meals pins it down. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner as a universal standard only crystallized in the mid-19th century. We're talking about a schedule that's maybe 180 years old, give or take. Before that, factory whistles basically told people when to eat. It wasn't biology, it wasn't tradition, it was shift schedules.
So the entire modern food industry, the cereal aisle, the lunch special, the dinner reservation, all built around a factory manager's whistle from the 1840s.
And once you see that, you start noticing how weird our assumptions are. Breakfast as a distinct morning meal was rare before the 1600s. Most people had what they called a morning draft, basically ale or watered wine, and then nothing solid until midday. The idea that you need to eat within an hour of waking up is a 20th century invention, and a lot of it came from cereal marketing.
Kellogg's deciding your metabolism for you. Love that.
John Harvey Kellogg was a whole thing, but yes, the breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Line traces back to advertising, not to any ancient wisdom. And here's the other piece that surprised me. Pre-industrial societies ate on wildly different schedules depending on class, season, and religion. 2 meals a day in medieval Europe, 4 or 5 in ancient Rome. The Japanese 3-meal system wasn't codified until the Edo period, 1603 to 1868. Before that, 2 meals was standard.
So the question isn't really, what's the natural human meal schedule? It's which century's arbitrary schedule do you want to adopt?
And that's actually liberating, not destabilizing. If none of this is hardwired, you can experiment without feeling like you're violating some biological imperative. Your body adapts to whatever consistent rhythm you give it. The National Geographic piece on meal history is really clear on that point. Human physiology is flexible. The 3-meal pattern is cultural, not metabolic destiny.
All right, so if the 3-meal system is this recent and this arbitrary, let's actually walk through what people ate before. Start with the most elaborate schedule. Ancient Rome.
So the Romans had 4 meals, and the structure is fascinating because it's almost inverted from ours. The day started with iantaculum. That's a dawn snack, basically. Bread dipped in wine or olive oil, maybe some olives or cheese. Very small, very quick. Then prandium around midday. Another light meal, cold food mostly, leftovers from the previous day's cena. Then the main event, cena, the big meal, served around 3 or 4 in the afternoon. This was the social anchor of the entire day. It could last 4 hours if you were wealthy, multiple courses, starting with eggs and ending with fruit. That's where the idiom ab ovo usque ad mala comes from eggs to apples, meaning from start to finish. Then a light evening meal called vesperna before bed.
Wait, the main meal was at 3 in the afternoon, and could run until 7 or 8 at night?
In wealthy households, absolutely. The cena was entertainment, status display, social bonding. You'd have the gustatio, the appetizer course, then the prima mensa, the main dishes, then the secunda mensa, the dessert course. All of it paced out over hours with conversation and wine between courses. And here's the thing, they ate reclining. The wealthy did anyway. Lying on couches, propped on one elbow, eating with their hands.
Sloths have been doing this for millennia. We call it Tuesday.
I'm sure you do. But the Roman schedule is actually remarkably practical when you look at it through a modern lens. The big meal happens during the part of the day when your insulin sensitivity is highest, midday to late afternoon. You've got hours of daylight left to digest. You're not going to bed on a full stomach. And the morning is light, just enough to break the overnight fast, which is literally what breakfast means, but without the lumberjack platter we've normalized.
So, the Romans accidentally nailed circadian eating 2,000 years before the National Geographic article told us about it.
They didn't have the metabolic science, but they were following daylight and social rhythm, and it happened to align. Now, jump forward to medieval Europe and the schedule contracts dramatically. Most people ate 2 meals a day. Dinner, and this is the big one, was served around 10 in the morning to noon. That was the main meal. Supper was lighter, around 4 to 6 in the evening. No breakfast. The morning draft I mentioned earlier, that's all most people had before dinner.
10 in the morning feels aggressively early for your biggest meal.
It makes sense when you remember, no artificial lighting. The working day started at dawn. By 10 a.m. you've already been up for 5 or 6 hours, you've been doing physical labor, you're hungry. And you want your calories when you still have a full afternoon of work ahead of you. Eating a huge meal at 7 p.m. and then sitting in the dark for 3 hours before bed would have seemed insane to them.
What were they actually eating at these meals?
For peasants, it was pottage. And pottage is basically a grain and vegetable stew that lived in a pot over the fire. You'd make a big batch, eat it for dinner at 10 or 11 in the morning, then reheat the same pot for supper in the late afternoon. Maybe you'd add whatever was available. A bit of salted meat if you had it, some herbs, root vegetables. But the core was grains, barley, oats, rye, bread on the side. Ale to drink? Everyone drank ale, including children, because the water wasn't safe.
The same pot of stew, reheated twice a day, every day. And we think we're bored with our meal prep.
The monotony is actually the point. These were caloric delivery systems, not culinary experiences. The multi-course feast with roasted meats and elaborate sauces was an upper-class thing, and even then it was rare. Feast days, weddings, religious holidays. The Atlas Obscura piece on medieval meals is very clear about this. The image of medieval people gorging on giant turkey legs all day is completely wrong. Most meals were simple, repetitive, and functional.
So you've got the Roman four-meal spread and the medieval two-meal contraction. What about the rere supper? That name alone is worth the price of admission.
The rere supper is my favorite detail in this whole history. So in noble households, supper was served in the early evening, say 5 or 6. But guests might arrive late, travel was unpredictable, the concept of a fixed dinner reservation didn't exist. So they developed this practice of a rere supper, a late-night meal served after supper, sometimes as late as 9 or 10 at night. It was lighter, cheese, bread, wine, preserved fruits, essentially a second supper for latecomers.
So the medieval nobility invented the midnight snack and gave it a formal name.
They did, and it was a recognized institution. It vanished when clocks and standardized schedules spread. Once you could coordinate arrival times, you didn't need the backup meal. The Atlas Obscura article traces this directly. The rere supper died because timekeeping made it obsolete, which is a perfect little case study in how technology shapes eating habits.
Before we leave the history, you mentioned Japan. What was happening there?
The Japanese case is interesting because it parallels the European pattern, but on a different timeline. Before the Edo period, which started in 1603, 2 meals a day was the norm, morning and evening, roughly. The 3-meal shoku system, Asagohan, Hirugohan, Bengohan, was codified during the Edo period as urbanization increased and merchant classes developed more structured daily routines. It wasn't ancient tradition, it was early modern urban planning, essentially. And even then, the meals were much smaller and simpler than what we'd recognize today. Rice, pickles, miso soup, maybe a bit of fish. The elaborate Japanese breakfast with multiple small dishes is a relatively modern phenomenon.
So across Rome, medieval Europe, Edo, Japan, the pattern is the same. Meal schedules were flexible, they responded to daylight and working class, and nobody thought their particular arrangement was the one true way to eat.
And that brings us to the knock-on effect of our modern 3-meal lock-in. The gap between meals is so long, 6 or 7 hours between lunch and dinner, that we invented a 4th meal without admitting we did.
Snacking.
Snacking now accounts for about 25% of daily calorie intake in the United States, according to the BBC Future article. A quarter of all calories come from food eaten outside of meals. We've created this whole parallel food industry, granola bars, protein shakes, trail mix, snack packs, because the 3-meal structure creates hunger gaps that pre-industrial schedules didn't have. The Romans ate 4 times a day and called it 4 meals. We eat 4 times a day and call 3 of them meals and 1 of them a snack, as if it doesn't count.
The snack is the Vesperna we won't admit to.
That's exactly what it is. And the snack industry is worth something like $150 billion globally because we pathologized eating between meals while simultaneously making the gaps between meals too long for most people's metabolisms.
All right. So this isn't just historical trivia. You got real implications for how people eat today. Let's talk remixes. If someone wants to actually adopt one of these pre-modern schedules, nonchalantly, without making it a whole personality, what are the options?
I've got 3 that I think are genuinely workable. The first one I'm calling the Roman Cena Shift. Here's how it works. You move your main meal to 3 p.m., have a light breakfast around 7 a.m., coffee, a piece of fruit, maybe toast, and then a small supper around 8 p.m. Something light, like the Roman Vesperna. Soup, bread, cheese. You're essentially front-loading your calories into the afternoon when your insulin sensitivity peaks, which is exactly what the circadian biology research in the National Geographic piece points to.
The metabolic case makes sense. What's the social friction?
That's the weak spot. If your family or friends eat dinner at 7, you're going to be sitting there with a bowl of soup while they're having a full meal. Or you're eating your cena alone at 3 while everyone else is at work. It works best if you have a flexible schedule, remote workers, freelancers, students. The other watch out, if you eat too light in the evening, you might wake up hungry at 3 a.m. The Romans didn't have to worry about that because they went to bed earlier.
So the cena shift is for people with schedule control. What's option 2?
Option 2 is the monastic 2 meal. This one's simpler, skip breakfast entirely, eat a large dinner at 11 a.m. and a moderate supper at 5 p.m. That's it. 2 meals, no snacks. You're essentially doing time-restricted eating, a 16-8 fasting pattern, but framed as historical practice rather than a biohacking protocol.
This is just intermittent fasting with a medieval coat of paint.
It is, and that's the beauty of it. Intermittent fasting has all this clinical baggage, apps, tracking, optimization. The monastic 2 meal is just, this is how most humans ate for centuries, and it worked fine. The metabolic benefits are the same. Improved insulin sensitivity, potential weight management, simplified decision making, but the framing makes it feel less like a diet and more like a rhythm.
What breaks it?
Evening social dinners. If someone invites you to dinner at 7, you've already eaten your supper at 5. You can either go and not eat, which is awkward, or you can shift your schedule that day and lose the consistency. It's also hard if you do physical labor in the morning. A monk could get away with no breakfast because he was praying, not hauling stones. If you're on a construction site at 7 a.m., the monastic 2 meal is going to feel punishing.
And the third remix?
The Rearer Supper Social. This one's for night owls. You keep a normal breakfast and lunch, nothing changes there, but you add a deliberate late-night meal around 10 p.m. Light, social foods, cheese, bread, wine, cured meats, fruit. It mirrors the medieval noble practice. And it works beautifully if you have a social life that runs late. Dinner parties, evening gatherings, people who don't even start thinking about food until 9.
So instead of snacking mindlessly while watching something at 10 p.m., you formalize it. You set a little spread. You call it rear supper. And suddenly it's not a bad habit. It's a historical reenactment.
The watch out is sleep. If you eat heavy food at 10 and go to bed at 11, your digestion is going to compete with your sleep quality. The medieval rear supper was light for a reason. Cheese, bread, wine. Nothing fried, nothing spicy, nothing that sits in your stomach like a brick. You also have to watch the alcohol. A glass of wine with your rear supper is lovely and historically accurate. 3 glasses and you're sabotaging your REM sleep.
So the rear supper is the most socially compatible because it doesn't disrupt your daytime schedule at all. You're just adding a meal rather than rearranging everything.
Right, and that's actually the key question for anyone trying these, which remix creates the least social friction for your specific life. Because the metabolic benefits don't matter if you can't sustain the schedule without becoming the person who's always explaining their weird eating rules at parties.
Which brings us to the nonchalance problem. How do you actually pull this off without sounding like you've joined a cult?
The framing matters enormously. You don't say, "I'm following a medieval monastic eating schedule." You say, "I've been trying this thing where I eat my bigger meal earlier in the day. I read it aligns better with circadian rhythms, and honestly, my afternoon energy is way better." That's true, it's grounded in actual science, and it doesn't make you sound like you own a tunic.
I read about this Roman thing also works. It's a conversation starter rather than a manifesto. People get curious instead of defensive.
And the curiosity is genuine. Most people have never heard of the Cena or the Rerer Supper. When you mention that the three-meal day is only 180 years old, it reframes the whole conversation. You're not the weird one for eating differently. The modern schedule is the weird one. It's just that everyone forgot it was invented.
So if someone's listening and wants to actually try one of these, what's the lowest friction entry point?
The monastic two-meal. Here's why. It simplifies decision-making. You eliminate an entire meal's worth of choices. What to eat for breakfast, when to eat it, do I have time, should I grab something on the way? That cognitive load just vanishes. You eat at 11, you eat at 5, you're done. The first 3 days, you'll feel hungry around 8 or 9 a.m. That's ghrelin, the hunger hormone, and it's entrained to your existing schedule. It adjusts within about 5 days. Drink water, have black coffee if you drink coffee, and the hunger passes.
And the afternoon focus thing, is that real or is that just people feeling virtuous about their new system?
It's physiologically real. When you skip breakfast and eat your first meal at 11, you're extending your overnight fast. Your body is running on stored glycogen and then shifting to fat metabolism. That produces ketones, which are a more stable fuel source for the brain than the glucose spikes and crashes you get from a carbohydrate-heavy breakfast. The mental clarity people report isn't placebo, though the virtuous feeling probably amplifies it.
I want to flag something about all three of these remixes. They all assume you have some control over your schedule. If you're working a factory shift, ironically, the very thing that created the three-meal system, or you're a nurse on 12-hour rotations, or you've got young kids who need to eat at specific times, a lot of this flexibility disappears.
That's a fair point, and it's actually historically consistent. The medieval peasant didn't choose the two-meal schedule. It was dictated by daylight and work demands. The Roman elite had the four-meal spread because they had leisure. Meal schedules have always been class markers. The difference now is that remote work and flexible schedules have given a larger portion of the population the ability to experiment than at any point since the Industrial Revolution locked everyone into the factory rhythm.
So we're not so much inventing new freedom as recovering old flexibility that industrialization flattened.
And you can already see it happening. The rise of lunch skipping among knowledge workers, the normalization of intermittent fasting, the decline of the formal business lunch. These are all movements away from the rigid three-meal structure. The meal schedule of 2050 might look more medieval than modern.
Let's talk about one more thing before we wrap. The breakfast myth, specifically. You mentioned Kellogg earlier.
The breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Lion is a masterpiece of marketing that we've mistaken for medical advice. It traces back to the early 20th century when cereal companies, Kellogg's, Post, were competing to establish breakfast cereal as a staple. They ran ads with language that sounded scientific, and it got repeated so often that it entered the culture as fact. But the actual research on breakfast is much more mixed than the slogan suggests. For some people, eating breakfast improves cognitive performance and reduces overeating later. For others, skipping breakfast has no negative effects and can improve metabolic markers. It's individual.
So the most important meal of the day is whichever one you're not being dogmatic about.
That's a better slogan than Kellogg's, honestly.
All right, let's land this. We've covered the Roman four-meal spread, the medieval two-meal contraction, the Rerer Supper, the Japanese Edo codification, and three practical remixes people can try this week. What's the single thing you want listeners to take away?
Pick one remix and try it for 5 days. The monastic two-meal is the easiest starting point. Skip breakfast, eat at 11 and 5. See how your energy and focus change. Track it against what you know about circadian biology. Your insulin sensitivity peaks around midday, so front-loading calories makes metabolic sense. Don't announce it, don't make it a personality, just try it and notice what happens.
And if someone asks why you're not eating breakfast, you've got the perfect nonchalant answer. I read about this Roman thing, and it's actually great for my energy levels. True, interesting, and not a manifesto.
The deeper point is that almost nothing about our daily rhythms is biologically mandated. The three-meal system is a valid choice, but it's a choice, not a law of nature. You can question it without rejecting modernity. You're just experimenting with a different setting on the same device.
Which raises the open question I want to leave people with. If the three-meal system is only 180 years old, what other natural daily rhythms are we going to dismantle in the next 180? The 8-hour sleep block is already under scrutiny. Biphasic sleep patterns, the midnight watch that people wrote about in pre-industrial diaries, the 5-day work week. The idea that you should eat the same number of meals every day regardless of season, activity level, or hunger. A lot of what we treat as biological imperative is just cultural inertia with good PR.
The remote work revolution is already cracking some of this open. When you're not commuting to an office with a scheduled lunch break, the three-meal structure starts to feel arbitrary. People are eating when they're hungry instead of when the clock says to. That's a return to pre-industrial patterns, whether they know it or not. The meal schedule of 2050 might look a lot more like the 14th century than the 20th.
And if anyone gives you grief about your rear supper, just tell them sloths invented it.
You're going to claim the rear supper now too? Along with pizza?
Sloths have been doing late-night cheese and bread for thousands of years. The medieval nobility just copied us.
I'm not even going to fact-check that. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, a British expedition to the Yamal Peninsula in Siberia collected samples of a deep crimson pigment traditionally made by the Nenets people from a mineral deposit rich in iron oxide and trace manganese, a pigment so light, fast, and stable that it was later analyzed by early spectroscopists and found to be nearly identical in chemical structure to the synthetic Mars red developed in European laboratories decades later.
Right.
Thanks, Hilbert.
The Nenets beat industrial chemistry to Mars red by a few thousand years, and nobody sent them a memo. All right, this has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, rate the show and tell a friend about the Rira Supper. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.